Good morning. We're on the record. Last night, the agency counsel in the Northover case filed a motion to dismiss. This morning, we received a response from appellant's counsel. We've taken the motion under advisement and will proceed with oral argument. The U.S. Merit Systems Protection Board will now hear oral argument in the cases of Conyers and Northover versus Department of Defense. MSPB docket number CH0752-09-0925-I-1 and AT0752-10-0184-I-1. Here today is the full MSPB, Vice Chair Ann Wagner, Member Mary Rose, and myself, Susan Sway Grundman, Chairman, presiding. Prior to this hearing, the parties stipulated to the following. The parties agree that the positions held by appellants Conyers and Northover did not require the incumbents to have a confidential, secret, or top secret clearance. The parties also agree that the positions held by appellants Conyers and Northover did not require the incumbents to have access to classified information. The parties are represented by counsel. We understand, however, that the Office of Personnel Management has declined to participate in these arguments. The board will hear first from Mr. Grijalis, counsel for Appellant Conyers. Mr. Grijalis is representing both Mr. Conyers and Mr. Northover and will be allotted 15 minutes for each appellant. Good morning, Mr. Grijalis. Yes.
On behalf of Rhonda Conyers and Von Northover, I am Andy Grijalis, and I would like to thank the board for offering Ms. Conyers and Mr. Northover the opportunity to present oral argument in this matter. They wish, however, to express that their regret that they were not able to be here in person today. May it please the board, full review of the merits underlying an agency's decision take an adverse action against a tenured federal employee is the default position of this board's authority. And when that adverse action is based on the loss of a qualification to hold a position, this review authority extends to a review of the merits of that loss of qualification. This is, as the board is aware, the Adams case. This is also the mandate of the board's enabling statute that directs that this board shall hear all matters committed to its jurisdiction under Title V of the United States Code and under Chapter 43 of Title 38. Because the board's jurisdiction is set by statute, the board has no power to diminish its own review authority or jurisdiction. This is a task, appellants believe, that is reserved to Congress. And in this regard, the board's powers with respect to this matter may best be understood as a very simple pie chart. The board's jurisdiction or review authority is like a large circle or a pie, and the Supreme Court in Department of the Navy versus Egan took a very fine-edged carving knife and took out, in its own words, a narrow slice of that pie. That slice being security clearance determinations involving access to classified information. In a sense, the Supreme Court reversed the inquiry I just spoke about by finding that when classified information was at issue, Congress would have to have spoken expressly, added rather than subtracted. But that is not what the board must do itself, and that does not extend outside of appeals involving access to classified information.
Mr. Grijalis, let me ask you just a question. You say that our jurisdiction is established by statute. DOD, in their response to your reply brief to the amici and the appellants, mentions that revocation of security clearances, along with revocation of eligibility to hold a non-critical sensitive position, they're not in our regulations. They're not specifically mentioned by our jurisdiction.
Yes, that is absolutely true. However, when looking at what this board's jurisdiction is, you must look to Egan. And so the default position is that an adverse action or the merits falls within the jurisdiction unless it is carved out. And Egan reversed that by finding with respect to classified information only, with respect expressly to security clearances, that is carved out based on separation of powers.
But Mr. Grahalis, you're talking about a default position with regard to jurisdiction, but the board's jurisdiction isn't plenary. It isn't broad. It's defined by statute. And the Supreme Court in Egan indicated that the statute precluded us from reviewing security clearance revocations. The issue I think that we have is that the rationale that the court employed in Egan could arguably extend beyond simply security clearance revocations to include other national security types of determinations, as is at issue here, arguably.
Appellants respectfully suggest that actually what the court in Egan found was not that the statute required, or that the statute 1204 deprived the Board of Jurisdiction. It was based on something other than the statute. It was based on the absence of anything in the statute, any express statement by Congress. And what the court found was that in order to include security clearance or classified information matters, Congress would have to have spoken explicitly. And it's absolutely true that the board's jurisdiction is not plenary. However, there is nothing else, as I will speak to in a moment, that deprives the board of jurisdiction over eligibility to occupy a sensitive position when there is no classified information at issue.
Well, what about the argument that the president's constitutional powers actually deprive the board of exercising that type of review?
That argument is weak when it is applied to cases involving eligibility to occupy a sensitive position in the absence of any security clearance and in the absence of any access to classified information, because if we go back and we look at Egan, what Egan teaches is that the court was completely concerned with the exposure of classified information, and that is where they found the president's power to be strong enough to override the silence in this board's enabling statute. And so, because, as we have undisputed here, where there is no classified information, there is no security clearance at issue, that rationale that drove the court in Egan to carve out a piece of the board's jurisdiction simply does not apply. Nor is there any other statute or regulation that would deprive this board of jurisdiction over a sensitive position eligibility matter. Simply put, because the loss of eligibility to occupy a sensitive position, not requiring a security clearance, and without access to classified information, does not fall within the narrow slice of pie taken out by Egan. Hence, the rule of Egan cannot apply. As I said, there is nothing, there is no other authority, no other power that removes eligibility matters from this board's jurisdiction. And if you look, as Vice Chair Wagner just said, the board's jurisdiction certainly is not plenary. But in any instance where the board's jurisdiction has been removed from review of the merits of an adverse action, it has done so by statute. If you look at non-appropriated fund employees, if you look at National Guard technicians, Veterans Canteen Service, Title 38 nurses, all of these groups of employees are removed by statute. They are removed by an act of Congress. There is nothing. There is no act of Congress. There is no regulation. Indeed, as OPM conceded in its advisory opinion, saying Part 732 of 5 CFR does not answer the board's question because it does not go to the board's jurisdiction.
What about Executive Order 14050?
14050 applies to the designation of positions. It doesn't speak to jurisdiction. And if you look at that order, It deals with an entirely separate matter. It is removed from access to classified information. And that leads to something that is critical to understand about Egan. That in Egan, what the court presupposed, because it was true in that case, is that there was access to classified information. They assumed, wrongly, that occupation of a sensitive position necessarily entails access to classified information. But we know that this is untrue. And we know, without doubt, that in this case, we have two non-critical sensitive employees who neither were required to hold a security clearance, nor were they required to have access to classified information.
But isn't it true that you are correct? It's one Executive Order 10450, but that was issued pursuant to 5 U.S.C. 7532, isn't that correct, among other authorities that the President cited?
I believe that to be accurate. However, there's nothing in 7532 that speaks to this board's jurisdiction over an action initiated pursuant to 7513. 7532 provides an alternative method, and that actually acts as a rebuttal to some of the arguments made by the agencies here. Undoubtedly, the agencies will argue that occupancy of a sensitive position is sufficiently analogous to possession of a security clearance that the rule of Egan should apply.
Okay.
So
let's say we agree with you. Let's say that we agree that Egan does not apply here. What kind of remedy would come out of this?
The remedy that the board would order would be dependent, obviously, on the type of case, but it would be reversal of the agency's action. And appellants believe that could include an order of reinstatement, possibly an order of remand to the agency to reconsider its decision, and possibly, as I said, an order of reinstating the appellant to the position. And that is because, as we see in this case, actually, if you look at some of the filings by the Defense Commissary Service, the argument that the employing agency will be without power to reinstate the employee is plainly false, because in Mr. Northover's case, it's clear that the agency head overturned a decision by the Consolidated Adjudications Facility, which denied Mr. Northover eligibility to occupy a sensitive position.
But are you saying that the board has the authority to order the agency to restore eligibility for occupying a sensitive position?
Yes, I think the board would have the authority to restore that to order that eligibility restored and to reinstate the employee.
But what standards would we use?
I believe, or appellants would argue, that the board would use the same standards that it uses in any other adverse actions. Whether the action serves the efficiency of the service, whether the agency has proved its case by preponderance of the evidence. And if you look at how the board has addressed similar cases, such as the recent Doe case, where the board was looking at the nexus of off-duty conduct to the efficiency of the service, this is an entirely analogous inquiry that the board could turn to that law to find the standard that the board should use when adjudicating cases involving eligibility to occupy a sensitive position.
But how would that standard work given the directive that agency heads only issue security clearances or grant access to classified information or deem people eligible to occupy sensitive positions if it's clearly consistent with the national security? How do you reconcile those?
You reconcile it, I believe, based on the distinction between access to classified information and eligibility to occupy a sensitive position that does not include that. I think you also reconcile it by looking to the board's grant of jurisdiction that if Egan does not apply, There is nothing that prevents the board. There is nothing that takes away the board's authority to look at that action and determine whether the agency's action supported the efficiency of the service, and that calculation that Vice Chair Wagner has just mentioned would fall within the analysis of that standard.
So it's contingent on essentially distinguishing the eligibility to occupy a sensitive position determination from the security clearance determination. Is that correct? Is that,
yes.
Does your argument
yes.
hinge on that? Okay. And how would you, so specifically, how would you distinguish those two determinations?
EGAN would apply in cases involving security clearances. The board would be limited to the procedural inquiries that it is limited to now in those cases. In eligibility cases to occupy a sensitive position, the board would look to see simply whether or not the agency has proven its case. Has it proven by a preponderance of the evidence that there is a nexus between the agency's determination and its action? And that would include, I believe, the review of whether the agency has proven its case, and as part of its case, it has to show some nexus, and that's going to be part of that inquiry. The distinction between a security clearance and eligibility to occupy a sensitive position also makes sense when we consider that it is the possession of a security clearance, and only the possession of a security clearance, that allows for the access of the classified national security information or material that EGAN was concerned with. That is the bright line when you look at cases such as this, where you may have a sensitive position, but you have no access. Mr. Northover, a commissary store manager, has no access to the type of information, for example, that Mr. EGAN had. Mr. EGAN had a security clearance because he was aware and he had access to the inside of nuclear submarines, the arrivals and departures of nuclear submarines prior to the fall of the Berlin Wall. Mr. Northover does inventory control in a store. He hangs signs and labels the aisles with whatever the specials may be. There is no risk because he has no access to classified information.
But, Mr. Grijalis, I think that's the question, isn't it? I mean, whose call is that to make? Do we, as a you know, through our statutory jurisdiction, have the ability to second-guess the agency's assessment that, as improbable as it might seem, that Mr. Northover could compromise national security, that's the agency's call to make?
And do we have the expertise to make that judgment?
In the absence of access to classified national security information, appellants argue that it is the mandate of this board that it makes exactly that inquiry into whether or not the agency has proven that nexus. And the expertise, this board has the expertise in determining, making nexus inquiries, making determinations whether or not a case has been proven by a preponderance of the evidence. If you look at Adams, as a sterling example of a case where the board clearly had the expertise to determine whether or not the agency's revocation of Adams's access to a sensitive computer system was both proven and served the efficiency of the service. The board clearly had the expertise to make that nexus decision. And thus the board has that expertise here in these appeals.
Well, I want to go back just very quickly to our discussion of remedy and what we can give the employee as in response to a positive answer. The case Skies versus Navy is informative to us in the sense that although it's talking about a security clearance, they do look, the court, our reviewing court, looks at the underlying questioning of whether somebody is properly classified. Is there an analogy? One. Two, even though it's a security clearance, doesn't the logic also follow in this particular case?
I'll begin by first pointing out that Skies and the companion case is also often cited, and I believe is cited in this case by both agencies, Brady, for the proposition that the board may not review a designation. Those two cases do not stand for the proposition that the board may not review, they don't extend, rather, to cases involving, that do not involve access to classified information. Both Skies and Brady had a security clearance. And so appellants submit, one, those cases are not precedential. Two, the law on that point is unsettled. And three, although they may be analogous to some extent, that is the wrong inquiry, because again, we go back to whether or not Egan should be applied. And so while it may be perhaps a similar determination, the dividing line is in when Egan applies, it is a determination that the board may not make, versus when Egan does not apply, because there is no access to classified information, nor is there a security clearance. It is a determination that the board might be able to reach in an appropriate case.
Why do you say that the law is unsettled on that question?
Because Skies and Brady do not reach beyond the arena of a security clearance. And so there is no precedential decision, appellants argue, extant, that speaks as clearly as Skies and Brady do to the board's authority to review the designation of a position when a security clearance is present or when access to classified information is present. However, appellants believe that the board does not actually need to reach this issue in order to decide this case. The appeals here do not extend, do not reach the designation. In other words, the appeals here are concerned instead with the denial or revocation, which is a very separate action than the agency's decision to designate a position. Now, while the board might be able, we believe, to reach the decision to designate a position, for example, in the presence of a prohibited personnel practice, it would certainly seem that once Egan does not apply, that is a personnel action, and if it were taken for a prohibited purpose, then it would qualify as a prohibited personnel practice.
I take it that you would agree that this is not a national security position. Could this be a public trust position that the appellants held, one of them still holds?
Could it be? Yes. Public trust, but not national security. And that is, you know, that is one of the critical points, is that to go back, whatever Congress may have intended, they certainly did not intend that entire civilian workforces of federal agency be deprived of the full scope of board review in the absence of any access to classified information. This is the rights of these types of employees was a critical factor in the NSPS litigation that concluded and that has since dissolved. Congress could not have intended that 100% of DFAS employees, for example, and we know that 100% of DFAS employees are in fact now designated as sensitive, they could not have intended that all of those employees be deprived of the full scope of board review sub silentio. That would make no sense to impute that intent to Congress.
I have a question about that. How do you, again, going back to the language in 5 U.S.C. 7532, which does delineate, which provides for summary dismissal of employees for national security reasons, Congress delineates, you know, agencies for which it was giving that authority. but also gives to the president the ability to identify other agencies. And that seems pretty open-ended to me in terms of a delegation of authority. And I'm just for purposes of exploring this point a little bit, how do we read into that language a limitation on the president's ability then to further identify employees who would fall within the summary dismissal authority under 7532?
The summary dismissal procedure on 7532 may extend to a broader group of employees. And that is, I think that we don't need to read a limitation there for purposes of dismissal under 7532 because it remains an alternate method of dismissal. So, for example, if in some unlikely scenario that is not presented here, we have an employee who lacks access to classified information but for one reason or another becomes a present national security risk, 7532 is there to allow the agency head to take swift action to remove or suspend that employee. It exists as a separate procedure. I see that my time is running down, and I'd like to reserve, unless the board has any further questions for me for rebuttal, if I may.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Grijalis.
Thank you.
Next, we have Mr. Yont from DOD DFAS. Welcome.
Good morning, Chairman Grundman, I apologize, Vice Chairman Wagner and Member Rose. May it please the Honorable Board, I'm Frank Yond from the Defense Finance and Accounting Service. With the permission of and the request of the Council of Record, I am presenting argument in this case. The board members have already discussed in some depth the extent of their authority. It's not plenary, as was pointed out, and it's not all-encompassing. One of the things that we wanted to examine today is a number of issues that can address or impact directly on that. Now, the case before the board, unfortunately, has a very limited record. It doesn't address any of the aspects that the federal government or Department of Defense looks at in determining a position to be non-critical sensitive or any of the procedures that are required, the appellate review and so on, of granting of a security clearance.
But Mr. Young, I'd point out that the limited record is a result of the agency filed interlocutory request for interlocutory review here.
No, that was done sua sponte by the administrative judge. The agency did not request interlocutory appeal.
I believe in Conyers, the agency filed.
No, the agency did not.
Then that would not reflect the interlocutory order that came from the judge. Never mind.
I recognize that.
Let's proceed.
Also not present in the record are the day-to-day functions of Ms. Conyers and her job performance. The question for oral argument raises the core issue of the jurisdiction of the board. The three areas that the board has requested that we specifically address today, the crux of those goes to the authority of the board and the jurisdiction of the board to respond. Appellant, in essence, has a burden of proving by preponderance of the evidence that the board does have jurisdiction, going from Carley versus Department of the Army, 413, Fed 3rd, 1354. Now, one of the examples that the appellants have relied heavily upon is Adams, and that addresses a relatively narrow issue of access to a specific computer system and was addressed as such. The question here is whether EGAN, if it arguendo does not apply, do we throw out the analysis that EGAN used to arrive at its conclusions?
But in Adams, the government strenuously argued, I believe, that EGAN applied in that case. So
yes.
Why, I mean, at this point, you're saying that the government's concerns were not apparent or relevant to that case?
Well, the core issue here was access to a specific computer system, and the argument was that EGAN did apply in order to address, in general, qualifications for a job. And this particular qualification involved access to a computer system. Now, in this particular case, we want to look at the argument here, turning to the authority of the president and national security matters.
Well, let me ask another question.
Yes,
follow
sir.
On. Was the basis of the designation of this position non-critical sensitive, was it for national security or for public trust reasons?
National security reasons. And of course, once again, it's not an issue in evidence in the record. But if I could present an example.
Let me just ask.
Sure.
Walk me through this.
All right.
Can the agency lump together national security and public trust into uber-sensitive positions, or are they treated separately?
They are largely distinct and separate. But there are, of course, occasions when both would apply to a given situation.
I'll tell you something. I pulled something out of the record. I'm going to give you a copy of it now along with the other board members.
Pardon my reach.
Can't get around the podium here.
And if you would give this to Mr. Bowles.
This came out of the record, the one that came up on interlocutory, and it talks about position sensitivity designation. And this one is, I think, this is Conyers. If you go to the second page and the third pages, neither the national security nor the public trust provisions are designated. In fact, what it looks like based on this document is that the designation for sensitive was for an IT reason, which would make sense because of Conyers' position that she held. So this doesn't tell me that this is a national security position. Let me ask another question.
Okay.
In order to change, you've made the assertion that this is a national security position. If you were to change a position from public trust or IT, do you have to notify the appellant?
Yes, we will.
And is there a process that the appellant faces in switching over to a different position, classification?
Well, it would determine on the circumstances of an individual position. But in a case such as Conyers, where the designation was changed to a non-critical sensitive position, that would then require a security investigation. The individual would be afforded the opportunity to respond to that investigation. There is a review process as to qualifying and disqualifying factors with respect to a given position. The individual employee can then respond in general.
This is for national security, right?
Yes.
And this is what Ms. Conyers faced?
Yes.
What's interesting is the OPM supplementary information, the supplemental response, indicated that there were two types of forms that employees would fill out, the SF-86 for national security and the 85P for public trust or other. You look like you have an answer.
I actually have the form in my hand.
Great, okay.
That the response was somewhat inaccurate with respect to the caption and the purpose of their own form. And that says here at the top, which under the purpose of the form, the United States government conducts background investigations to establish that applicants or incumbents, either employed by the government or working for the government under contract, are suitable for the job and are eligible for public trust or sensitive positions. So it specifically references in the form sensitive positions.
So this, which form? Is this SF-86 or 85?
This is the 85.
This is the 85. Okay.
And we could offer in evidence with record open to receive it, the rationale for creating the 85P as opposed to just the 85, and concessions to the privacy of the individual employees rather than the more intrusive 86, when sensitive positions versus clearance issues.
So non-national security sensitive positions can also fill out an SF-85?
Yes.
Okay.
And it's specifically stated in the purpose of the form.
Mr. Young, I believe that OPM did indicate in its response to our inquiry that that was not an accurate a characterization of the use of the forms. Do you disagree with OPM on that?
Well, I would have to, based upon the instructions that they have, literally on the face of the form itself.
And just to clarify, what, from the agency's perspective, is the significance of the form here as between the SF-86, SF-85, and SF-85P for purposes of this case?
For purposes of this case, largely the differences would be the amount of intrusion into the information that the applicant would have to complete.
No, but I mean in terms of what it indicates about the agency's assessment of the position. I mean, are you saying that if the agency uses an SF-86 form, it is evidence of its determination that it is a national security position?
No, that it entails classified information.
Okay.
That the,
but you've stipulated that there's no classified information involved in this case.
Which is why an 86 is not...
Okay.
Not a part of this particular determination.
Okay.
That the one of the issues that seems to be focused upon here as we go through this is the equation of unclassified with not being national security sensitive information. And even in Egan, as we go through, the court made a separate determination before it started speaking with respect to the classified information issue, that the that non-classified sensitive information is within that the presidential authority that is addressed in 10450. Going directly to the language of the court as it comes into this. We have, pursuant to these directives, department and agencies of the government classify jobs in three categories: critical sensitive, non-critical sensitive, and non-sensitive. Then it goes on to discuss separately clearances. It goes on to say that different levels of clearance are required depending upon the position sought. A government appointment is expressly made subject to a background investigation that varies according to the degree of adverse effect the appellant could have on national security. Now, one of the points that appellants have made in this is that the Congress has not spoken, and the fact that Congress has not spoken with respect to sensitive information, then therefore it is by fiat separate and distinct. That's not true. Congress has spoken with respect to sensitive information. When it goes in and discusses the security clearances and the requirements for security clearance, it examines what the Secretary of Defense needs to do in order of process. But in discussing that, it speaks specifically to unclassified positions. Now, in the statute that addresses, the statute that addresses the scope of the security investigations, which is 10 U.S.C., 1564, down at the bottom, it addresses specifically sensitive information. And it says, for the purpose of this section, it is not necessary for the performance of duties to involve classified activities or classified matters in order for the duties to be considered sensitive and critical to national security, specifically citing to 10 U.S.C. 1564E. Now, I realize I haven't addressed specifically the three questions you've asked. I have just a couple of minutes remaining. I'd be very happy to answer whatever questions you have, or if you'd like me to address the three questions you presented, I can do that briefly.
Let's try that, and we'll come back.
Okay, thank you. Okay, first questions, the issues the board requested the party address. First, does the board have authority to review an agency's reasons for determining positions as non-critical sensitive if the positions do not require eligibility for access to classified information? The answer, based upon what we just saw from Congress, is no, because that is still sensitive defense-related information. And it goes directly to the expertise that the court addressed with respect to the agencies to examine these positions and to determine whether or not there's classified information, whether or not there's sensitive information. We go to the example of a number of separate things that a contracting specialist could see. First, there is a contract for meals ready to eat. There is a contract for transfer of troops. There's a contract for transfer of household goods and equipment. There are also issues with respect to the contracts as to whether or not they're being satisfied. All of these taken as a whole, present a mosaic, that does contain sensitive national defense information. So it is, as the board pointed out earlier, there is a degree of expertise at looking at these individual positions to determine the impact of these on national security. That turning to the latter two questions, I'll answer those kind of a lump in the remaining 19 seconds. The regulations require that in order to designate a position as sensitive, they must be based upon considerations of national security interests. So the determination,
or public trust, or IT, at least that form tells me.
I'm out of time, but I can respond.
I have a couple of questions.
Sure.
So is it your position that there is no determination of national security that the executive branch can make that is reviewable by any other entity?
I wouldn't say that it's not reviewable by any other entity. And it would also say that Congress does have the authority to extend review into these areas. That at this juncture, the issue of determination of whether or not a position entails national security sensitive information and whether or not an individual is eligible to occupy such a position is within the realm of executive authority.
Well, let me just follow up then. I mean, a number of years ago, 20 years ago, there was drug testing litigation that involved widespread, were challenges to the government's widespread designation of positions as subject to random drug testing because they implicated national security concerns. And the Supreme Court had no problem, I think, although when it finally reached that court, the record wasn't fully developed with regard to the particular positions that was before it in terms of any national security implications. But the court certainly expressed a lot of skepticism as to a number of positions that had been designated on national security grounds for random drug testing. And I would just like you to speak to this question of, I mean, isn't it within the purview of certainly, you know, the courts, and I would say by extension Congress, and Congress as delegated to us, to review these sort of broad-based delegations of positions as implicating national security?
I would think that in these situations, we would have to look to the underlying authority upon which an individual court would have rested its opinion. Here we have potential issues involving individual personal liberties, whereas there's no property, you know, there's a property interest in an individual's body. The individual obviously has that authority. There's no such property interest in security clearance. And by extension, there's no indication, there's no case law to support that that extends to the right to access national security information or to occupy a position that involves access to national security information.
But what about Cole? I mean, Cole specifically says that national security should be narrowly interpreted. It goes to great lengths to emphasize that it can't be everywhere.
Well, the issue here isn't the fact that it can be everywhere.
Well, but I'm asking you the question.
Okay.
I mean, does Cole not apply? Is it not informative here?
I think that it is informative, but I don't believe that it is more so than Egan when it examines specifically the characterization as of positions as sensitive or non-sensitive.
But Egan relies on Cole to some extent.
Yes, just to some degree. But the board the court specifically addressed separately and distinctly from the security clearance aspect the designation of positions before it even went on to examine security. So I think that it can provide some instruction, but I think here the court in Egan very specifically looked at the very specific issue of designation and sensitivity of positions and addressed those very specifically.
I just have one more question. I mean, is there any doubt that the agency could have taken a disciplinary action against Ms. Conyers under 7513?
I, quite frankly, am not certain based upon the facts and circumstances.
Well, I mean, in theory, in the sense that not...
If there were such an egregious violation that she had cold cocked her supervisor.
No, I think this is a good question. I mean, the question is, she lost her eligibility to hold this position. The agency could have just fired her rather than said, you've lost your eligibility here.
The question is, if the agency could, I mean, the agency could have proceeded under 7513. And so what you're really asking us to determine and to hold is that the appellant's rights as a tenured employee to third-party review is contingent on the agency's characterization or decision to pursue a certain process rather than another process.
As the court addressed in Egan, these are parallel processes and that they're not exclusive one to the other. The election of the agency to proceed under national security requirements and authorities is permissible.
Thank you, Mr. Yacht.
Thank you for your attention and kind concern.
Mr. Haas, we've gone way over with Mr. Yacht, so if the deputy clerk wants to add two more minutes onto Mr. Grijalis's rebuttal time in the event you need it. Next up, Ms. Caldwell for DOD Defense Commissary Agency in the Northover case. Good day to you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the board, I'm Stacey Turner Caldwell. And without waiving the Defense Commissary Agency's objections pursuant to our motion to dismiss, I am here to represent the Defense Commissary Agency in oral argument in the case of Northover. Here, pursuant to the authority granted to the Defense Commissary Agency by virtue of Executive Order 10450 as amended and further under 5 CFR Part 732 and Department of Defense Regulation 5200.2R-R, the agency designated the position of Commissary Management Specialist as a moderate risk national security position with a sensitivity level of non-critical sensitive. When Mr. Northover occupied that position, that meant that he did have to go through a background investigation and that he had to maintain eligibility to occupy a sensitive position. When that eligibility was denied, the agency took action to remove Mr. Northover solely based on the denial of that eligibility. The agency submits that the precedent in Egan limiting the scope of the board's review clearly applies to this case also, because the authority that was exercised by the agency comes by virtue of the same executive order as the authority that was exercised by the agency in the Egan case to designate security positions and security requirements.
Well, just to clarify, that executive order is 10450, is that?
Yes, okay. Ma'am. Now, in designating the levels of security clearance required, and just to be clear, security clearance formally is often used to refer just to confidential, secret, and top secret clearances. However, that term is also used in the vernacular to refer to all background checks that have to be run and passed in order to hold a position.
So are you arguing that Egan, even though it specifically addresses security clearances, should actually means it covers any type of investigatory element in an employee's career?
Yes, Your Honor, I'm arguing that Egan applies equally because this is the same type of security determination where the authority for making that security determination in the interests of protecting national security is exercised by the agency under the same authority.
But the authority is it 12698, talks about an affirmative action that the granting official takes when they issue a security clearance. It's not the same thing that occurs here.
And I said there are two different ways that security clearances are referenced. Yes, it formally applies to those particular clearances covered under there. However, it also is utilized to reference the entire realm of background investigations that apply to positions. And within the Department of Defense, in terms of talking about security designations, we refer to all of the security designation determinations that are made as clearance decisions.
So that is a vernacular that the DOD uses?
Yes. And more importantly...
Excuse me, counsel, can I ask, and I understand that this was a representation that was made in the Conyers case, but in the brief in that matter that was submitted to the board, the government argued that the determination as to whether, or I should say it was in a footnote, so it wasn't a full argument, but the determination as to whether to grant a security clearance and whether an individual is eligible to occupy a sensitive position were separate inquiries. How does that comport with what you're indicating now, which is that it's just all one amorphous review?
Well, Your Honor, I can't really speak to what was intended by that footnote. I can tell you I'm not saying they're the same level.
Wasn't that your footnote?
No.
It's the other. Okay.
I'm not saying they're the same level. What I'm saying is that there are both determinations made in the interest of national security by virtue of the same authority, and that authority rests with the President of the United States as Commander-in-Chief and is delegated to the agency head to make those determinations and to ensure that they're effective in protecting national security. It's a difference in degree of protection that the agency head has made a decision is needed, not in terms of the kind of protection that's needed and the kind of designation. They're all security designations.
I'm interested just to explore for a minute the arguments that both the government agencies made in these cases, which is that the authority of the president in this regard rests in the commander-in-chief authority. And it seems that you both have that authority be construed extremely broadly to and exclusively. Is that essentially your contention that when the president exercises this authority, it is non-reviewable, exclusive authority?
Our contention is that the president has delegated that authority to the agency heads and no one else. And what goes along with that is that the agency head, in addition to having the authority for making the decision, the agency head has the responsibility for ensuring that decision is a good one. And so if you get into other entities interfering in the agency's head ability to make these very close judgment calls, then there's a problem because the agency spend a considerable amount of time consulting with experts who have specialized knowledge in this area.
Right, but what I'm asking you is the president's authority isn't exclusive in this regard. I mean, if you look at the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, Congress has authority to regulate the armed and naval forces and to govern them. Congress has the authority to appropriate for the military. Congress has the authority to determine, you know, to establish a uniform code of military justice. I mean, there's a lot of play there in terms of the very, you know, the respective authorities of the legislative branch and,
yes, Your Honor,
and the executive branch.
Yes, Your Honor, and Congress certainly would have the authority to take action to modify the current state of things if that was their decision to do so. Our contention here is that as things stand now, pursuant to Executive Order 10450, the agency head has both the authority and the considerable amount of responsibility and accountability for making these decisions. And Congress has not delegated to anyone the authority to intervene in that exercise at this point.
Let's talk about that authority in this particular case.
Yes, ma'am.
In your motion to dismiss, you indicate that whereas in 2009, Mr. Northover was deemed ineligible for whatever reason, but as recently as a few days ago, a week ago, he is now deemed eligible. What changed?
Well, for one, we're in litigation, Your Honor, and that changed, but I will tell you the important distinction, the important point is that the person who changed the decision is the head of the agency.
That's not the
very
question.
Person
That's
who not the... is responsible for making that decision.
Understood. Here's the question. What changed from 2009 to a week ago?
The head of the agency determined to grant a waiver of the factors that were represented as risk factors in this particular case, and that responsibility is his because that discretion solely rests with him. And before, in 2009, he deferred to the expertise of Washington Headquarters Services, which is the agency that is delegated to conduct the background investigations and make those decisions.
What if 2 weeks from now the agency head determines that Mr. Northover is no longer eligible?
Well, that's certainly within his authority too, Your Honor. And I don't always understand decisions that are made that are outside the realm of my authority and expertise. But our point is that respectfully, the Merit System Protection Board does not have the authority nor the expertise to intervene in the president's exercise of his authority to make decisions on national security matters and national security designations by virtue of the delegation to the agency head. And I especially want to point out in terms of the expertise that's involved, because again, someone on the outside reviewing the situation may not understand why a commissary employee is deemed to be in a non-critical sensitive position. But I think one of the important things to look at is
I have a question for you, too.
An answer to that question, where you were going, but go ahead.
Okay. I'm sorry. I thought that you... Your talk about this discretion and the expertise, and from your briefs, I gathered that part of that kind of calculation about the expertise was in the predictive assessments of the behavior of the employee in terms of future conduct and whatnot, that the agency had some particular expertise in that regard. But isn't it the case in any removal that there is always an assessment of predictive behavior? And that there's nothing inherently unique about an agency head's ability to assess that renders it unreviewable by the board. I mean, the board reviews those assessments all the time in the context of Douglas factor analysis. You know, is rehabilitation, you know, a reasonable possibility? Will this misconduct occur again? I mean, those are types of considerations that are fully within the board's purview.
Yes, Your Honor, normally they are. However, in this case versus other cases, you have Egan. And it is our contention that Egan directly applies to this situation
squarely.
Naturally,
we don't
by
have
virtue
to,
of the rationale.
We don't have to expand Egan at all in order to apply to this case.
It is our view that it's not an expansion of Egan in this instance because the same rationale that prompted the court in Egan to make the limit, to place the limit on the scope of review, applies here also because it is the same type of security determination pursuant to Executive Order 10450 as was made then. And I think importantly, one thing that we need to look at is in talking about classified information, there is a distinction. You're looking at classified information, which is by virtue of the nature of the information itself deemed classified. In these instances where a position is sensitive but does not involve access to classified information, excuse me, can I get some water, please? You're talking about the position being designated as sensitive because of the nature of the position.
Not the material.
Okay. And there are many instances. Thank you very much. Excuse me. There are many instances where experts who spend an extensive amount of time studying issues with regard to military operations and the information that someone can gain know that someone can take a particular bit of information that's not classified about troop movements, troop-based populations, and they can apply that information in a way that can bring about a materially adverse effect on national security. And so what I'm trying to point out is that it's the same type of decision. It involves a lot of expertise that maybe we wouldn't understand just looking at it, but someone has spent an awful amount of time making these decisions. They're very difficult judgment calls, and it's the agency head that's ultimately responsible for ensuring that the system is effective. And for the same reason that the court in Egan determined that that particular judgment call shouldn't be interfered with, it shouldn't be interfered with here.
Yeah. You wanted to talk about national security as it pertained to this position. I'd love to hear it.
With regard to the commissary management specialist?
Correct.
Yes, Your Honor. With regard to the commissary management specialist, Mr. Northover was involved in entering special orders into the system. Commissary management specialists are able to gain information about troop movements at times, about populations on the base, about the presence of dignitaries on the base, the food supply going to different military units. That information could be used by someone to interfere with military operations. It is by virtue of what we do within the Department of Defense that supplies the reason that you find so many sensitive positions in the Department of Defense. The same position at Department of Labor may be classified differently. Your Honor, I'm out of time, but I'll be glad to continue to answer questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for the time.
Thank you.
Joining us today are also two amici who will split their time. Mr. Devine and Ms. Wilson, let's go in alphabetical order. Mr. Devine.
May it please the board, my name is Tom Devine. I'm legal director of the Government Accountability Project and representing GAP as an amicus. The board is to be commended for seeking argument on this issue because the stakes could not be higher. The ruling is an opportunity to restore a consistent set of rules throughout the civil service for access to the merit system. Secondly, to maintain the rule of civil service law over a potentially all-encompassing national security loophole. And third, to clarify the boundaries for Egan versus Department of Navy that reflect the Supreme Court's mandate, rather replacing the previous board's activism to expand Egan. By expanding Egan, the board ironically created an outcome where judgment calls with the least national security significance receive the largest exemption from the merit system, somehow on grounds of national security. There's something very wrong with that picture. The premises for our argument are, first of all, that Egan was a decision on security clearances and security clearances alone. While there was much commentary about the context for it, that was the ratio decided. And that it was grounded in the search for statutory authority to support board authority. It simply found none. Unlike the context in Egan, however, with respect to prohibited personnel practices, Congress has established the boundaries of the board's authority in 5 U.S.C. 2302, section 2302 A2B and C. Those establish the scenarios where the board is barred from intruding on national security decisions, either for individual jobs or for particular categories of jobs. There is no other authority in the statute which limits the board's power to police the merit system and guard against prohibited personnel practices. An open-ended qualifier, such as the definition in Executive Order 10, Executive Order that is controlling here, cannot even pass constitutional muster. The definition in the executive order is covers jobs that could bring about material adverse effect on national security. As I think the amicus was ably demonstrated, that could potentially affect any job that exists in the federal government. Anyone who wants to engage in mischief has the capacity to have an impact. That is not an adequate boundary, though, for limiting the board's authority to police the merit system. There was an analogous circumstance in American Foreign Service Association versus Garfinkel in the 1980s, where the court disallowed free speech restrictions based on the concept of classifiable instead of classified, because the former category could apply to all communications. We are in the due process equivalent of that scenario here, and there's no constitutional basis for such an amorphous concept to be the bright line boundary of legal rights.
Mr. Devine, has Executive Order 10450 ever been challenged, to your knowledge? Has it ever been challenged? Has the Executive Order 10450 ever been challenged?
I couldn't give you a researched response to that. Your Honor, we don't think that there is a problem with having that broad standard as a premise and a principle for making decisions. It's just like the efficiency of the service. But within those broad contexts, you have to have particular, tangible boundaries for the exercise of rights, not an open-ended possibility that you won't be covered by the merit system.
I'm interested in getting your response to the question that I posed to Mr. Grahalis earlier, which is that that executive order is based in part on the statutory authority at 5 U.S.C. 7532, which contemplates, on the face of it anyway, that the president could delegate or could designate positions with no statutory standard to limit that designation. So where would we get such a limitation?
First, I would say that there are broader categories that require less review of agency action. And if an agency wants to exercise its authority and avoid review, it should go to those particular categories rather than trying to neuter the adverse action procedures and due process rights.
Isn't that what I thought that's what you were accusing the government of doing here, which is to essentially resorting to non-statutory approaches to dismissing employees in order to avoid the appellate process that's provided in the statute?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I think the government is trying to avoid review. I think they probably picked the wrong basis in their attempt to avoid review. But even in Section 7532, there's nothing which says the board is deprived of authority to enforce the congressional bans against prohibited personnel practices. It would streamline the process for a merits decision, but it doesn't exempt those decisions from the merits system itself. With respect to the arguments that these have been covered quite thoroughly, so I don't want to be repetitive, but it is worth pointing out that counsel is rebutted himself by referencing the broad context for the discussion in Egan and the fact that Congress has created different categories of jobs. In none of those circumstances were any restrictions placed on the board. He has demonstrated and illustrated the background nature of what the government is attempting to make as tangible walls or barriers to board review. Secondly, amicus stated that everything connected with a security clearance decision is part of a security clearance decision. That simply doesn't reflect current law. For example, Brown and other decisions initially cited by the board are well taken. In the Jacobs decision in 1994, the Army tried to avoid review by disqualifying an employee under the Chemical Personnel Reliability Program.
But Jacobs had a security clearance.
I'm sorry? Mr.
Jacobs had a security clearance in that case.
But it's another unreviewable way to remove him from employment. And the board said in order to avoid review, the clearance had to be removed. It couldn't be done through that vehicle. The board, Executive Order 12968, has separate categories for security clearance and preliminary determinations. Section 1.2A, I believe it is regarding security clearances directly. Section 1.2C involves those preliminary steps, such as background investigations or signing a non-disclosure form. And the board has authority to review non-disclosure forms to make sure that they don't cancel prohibited personnel practice rights in the Whistleblower Protection Act. Amicus also stated that the board doesn't have the expertise for anything connected with a security clearance decision. The board exercises that expertise routinely in areas involving national security, reassigning an employee from a job with more national security duties to less, a failure to provide training necessary for national security positions. These are all covered by prohibited personnel practices. Finally, Your Honors, I'd like to point out that the Crumpler doctrine that we are considering cannot coexist with the merit system. Controls are necessary to deal with a rapidly proliferating phenomenon to exploit this loophole. The Department of Justice and three-quarters of the U.S. attorney positions have sensitive positions. This is applying to all civilian employees of military bases, as this case shows, most IRS employees, all law enforcement or inspector general agents, all TSA baggage screeners. There will not be any guaranteed merit system if the board doesn't establish a bright line defending its authority in this area. The alternative will be a futile hodgepodge of inconsistent rules. For example, in the Navy, these preliminary determinations get the same due process as security clearance actions. In the Department of Justice, they get none. Your Honors, this is a very significant opportunity to restore coherence to the stages that are preceding the decision which properly is reserved for the President.
Thank you, Mr. Devine. Ms. Wilson.
Good morning, or are we in afternoon? May it please the Board, my name is Julie Wilson, and I'm here today representing the National Treasury Employees Union as amicus. The issue before you is far simpler than agency counsel suggests. Plainly put, does the board have the authority to review the underlying merits of a adverse action involving an employee who does not have access to classified information. As my colleagues from AFGE and GAP have just explained, the answer to that question is unmistakably yes. I think it would be helpful to summarize just some of the main points here today. It's undisputed that as a general matter, the board has jurisdiction over the adverse actions present in this case, a removal and an indefinite suspension. The board's jurisdiction to review the merits of an adverse action, such as it is at present here, is limited in only the most narrow of cases. There's a strong statutory presumption in 1205 and Chapter 77 that the board will review any underlying decision leading up to that adverse action. The agency attempts to avoid board review, but here, by citing to Egan, which is admittedly one of those narrow exceptions. But in doing so, the agency mistakenly glosses over the critical fact. That is that neither Conyers nor Northover were required to access classified information or to hold a security clearance, the dispositive fact in Egan. The agency thus errs when it tries to extend Egan to a situation that simply was not present there. In fact, as we've talked about, as my colleagues have talked about, the Egan court made very, very clear that it was addressing the most narrow question of whether the board could review the merits of a revocation of a security clearance. In ruling that it did not, the court took great care to stress its concerns about the president's ability to protect the nation's most critical secrets. I want to address two of the points made by agency counsel today. One, counsel alleges that the Egan court made two separate inquiries, that the court looked to the president's purportedly a broad power to dictate what would be in the interest of national security, and then look to see whether that applied in a security clearance context. And I respectfully suggest that that's not really what happened in Egan. Egan, at its very outset, acknowledged that it was only looking at a very narrow question, the question of whether the board could review the security clearance. It concluded that it did not, but then went through to support that conclusion, looking at what the statute provided, looking at what that statute, what Congress intended by issuing the statute, and that is to agency counsel's second point, congressional intent. When the Egan court looked at the question of the review of a security clearance, it was doing so in an environment where very few employees had a security clearance. It was looking at what Congress would have intended for a small group of employees, whether Congress would have potentially have allowed for that small group of employees to be denied full board review. Here, it is the polar opposite situation. As we've all talked about in our briefs, this decision has the potential to affect tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of garden variety federal employees. And I respectfully suggest that Congress could not have intended to deprive that significant number of federal employees full board review over adverse actions.
I have a question, counsel. It seems to me that argument can kind of cut both ways, which is that at the time that Egan was decided, I think the same concerns about the possibility of agencies resorting to security clearance determinations in order to circumvent the statutory rights of federal employees with regard to removals and whatnot, that agencies would wholesale start issuing security clearances just in order to circumvent. And that actually hasn't happened, I think, to a great extent, or at least we haven't heard any of the parties indicating that that has actually happened. So the idea that by rendering this eligibility determination non-reviewable, we are going to be opening up the floodgates to, wholesale deprivation of employee rights, is that a concern that is reasonable to anticipate given the history of how Egan was interpreted from the agency?
I think so, Your Honor, because there's a process for the designation of a security clearance. An agency must show that the employee will have access to classified information in order to even seek that the security clearance required, to even seek the permission to give the person a security clearance. So there's certainly a process and a procedure that the agency has to go through in order to get a security clearance. And that could be one of the reasons why we haven't seen this wholesale requirement that all employees go through the security clearance process, because it's expensive and it's time-consuming, as we talked about in the background investigation for the SF-86. On the other side, there doesn't appear to be any process, and I'd like to take agency counsel's assertions at face value that people with great expertise are making these decisions about the designations of these employees, of these positions rather, as national security positions. There's nothing in the record to suggest how these designations are made, by whom they're reviewed, whether it's the lowest graded HR employee or the head of the Department of Defense who's deciding whether these positions are national security positions. And in fact, I think that OPN somewhat concedes that there isn't really a established process for reviewing the designations. And so with that, in the absence of any regulatory or executive branch review over national security designations, I think that there is a strong and real concern that the agencies would have their unfettered discretion to reclassify all positions and thus avoid any type of review.
Well, I had to take a look at the executive order, but I believe that the executive order itself contemplates that OPM should be undertaking a consistent review of agency designations to ensure that they're being done consistent with real national security concerns and whatnot. And
there's nothing in the record that speaks to that, and OPM did not address it in its letters, March letter or April letter.
But they do. I mean, you would concede that the agency does have the authority to do that.
That OPM would have the authority?
Yes.
Certainly, to look at the interpretation and application of its own regulations. What I would suggest is it doesn't appear that that is happening to date.
Well, and I also want to ask you, because under 7532, in addition to extending the designation authority to the president, you know, after delineating the specific agencies that, in Congress's view, apparently implicated national security concerns, it says that the designation should be submitted to the Committee for Armed Services for review if those designations are made. I mean, do you know if those designations have been submitted to congressional?
That specifically.
Okay.
I don't know. Now, that does raise an important point that I wish to address based on your earlier questions to both Mr. Devine and agency counsel about the application of 7532. I think it's significant here and important that the agency didn't proceed under 7532. We're dealing with a Chapter 75 removal. If they had wanted to, assuming that they could show the imminent risk to national security, they could have attempted to remove these employees under 7532. So the analysis of that section of 7532 and its potential limitations and how the agency need apply it is somewhat irrelevant to the resolution of the issue here. Here, the agency made a decision to proceed under Chapter 75. It proposed the removal and the indefinite suspension of these two employees. In doing so, that means that the board has, under Chapter 77, review of those adverse actions. Once the agency proceeded under Chapter 75, the consequences of that flow from their decision. The board has very clear statutory review over Chapter 75 removals and indefinite suspensions. And in fact, you know, I wanted to also speak to expand on a little bit of what we talked about earlier about the concerns should the rationale in EGAN be applied to this vast majority of federal employees. There certainly appears to be a significant trend towards reclassifying a number of federal positions as sensitive. As I pointed out earlier, there's no information either in the record or even anecdotally that NTU is aware of about how these decisions are made, and there doesn't appear to be any oversight currently in place for these designations. our concern is that agencies, in the absence of such oversight, are going to have this unfettered discretion to strip federal employees of their statutory rights to full board review. And NTE was actually aware of a situation that we referenced in our brief, where this very situation is happening. We have an employee whom we represent who the removal was proposed, went to an arbitrator. The arbitrator struck down the reasons that the agency presented for the removal. It required and ordered the employee to be reinstated in his job. And by coincidence, very shortly after reinstatement, this employee was subject to a reinvestigation because his position is sensitive. Now, that's currently before the adjudicator as to whether the employee is eligible, but it is strongly expected that the employee will be found to be ineligible to occupy his sensitive position. And if Egan were to apply, that would mean that the agency would have had a second bite at the apple to use the very same reasons that were struck down by the arbitrator for removing the employee from his position. That doesn't seem consistent with what Congress intended when it set up the CSRA. It doesn't seem consistent with what the Merit Systems Protection Board jurisdiction requires, that to have agencies have the opportunity to strip employees of review rights just by designating a position as a sensitive position is inconsistent. It's inconsistent. As the board itself points out in Jacobs, given its role of the protector of the Merit Systems Protection Board.
I have a question, and I'm not sure if the case that you were describing involved the, you know, access to that internal, arguably independent review that I guess in DOD employees are entitled to with regard to eligibility as well as security clearance revocations.
That type of internal review is pretty consistent. This happened to be a DHS employee, but the review procedure for eligibility determination seems pretty consistent across the government, that there is a initial decision about eligibility, the employee is given an opportunity to respond, those very basic due process rights.
So why isn't that sufficient in this particular case?
Because in this case, as in Conyers and Northover, there is serious concern that the employee did not have the opportunity to, let me address this a different way. That type of review is not sufficient to guarantee the employee's full statutory rights under board review. That it is simply a matter of turning in a piece of paper that says, I disagree with the agency, and then the agency has complete discretion to either read it or throw it out or disregard it altogether. I mean, because there is no review process, we have no idea what the agency does with the...
But I think it was in one of the agency's briefs that this is a six-tier review in this particular case. It's not just hand in a paper
right. And
seal it off. It seems to be some sort of a calculated process before eligibility is denied.
And it could be six, it could be 12, but if it's all cloaked in this mystery about what happens behind the scenes, it does. I don't think it really matters, because what the end result is that the agency has complete discretion to decide whether the employee is eligible to occupy the sensitive position, and they can do so. Presuming that their position stands, they can do so knowing that there's no review of that. So how do we protect an employee from discrimination, from a prohibited personnel practice, from retaliation, from from constitutional violations, from all of the assertions and claims that have been repeatedly struck down in the Egan context? I mean, as you know, that when security clearance is required, the court has repeatedly said, if Egan applies, our ability to look at even discrimination is very, very limited. Our ability to look to see whether the employee has been retaliated is very, very limited, if not non-existent. So I acknowledge that there might be some type of internal review process. I respectfully suggest that's not enough. And there's nothing in the statute to suggest that that is enough. The board has clear statutory jurisdiction to review these types of adverse actions. Absent some type of congressional act or a court decision that narrows the board's jurisdiction, it is We suggest that it is not for the board to go in there and to apply EGAN to limit its own jurisdiction.
Thank you very much. I believe we're back with Mr. Grijalis. 12 minutes. How much time? We gave him 2 extra minutes.
Thank you to the board again for this opportunity. To piggyback off of what was just discussed, appellants suggest that even if an agency's internal review were sufficient, that still would not allow the board to abdicate its responsibility under the statute to adjudicate the merits of an adverse action appeal. Not only that, internal review is not sufficient for the simple reason that there is no third-party neutral review. This is an exclusively internal review process, whether it be within the Department of Defense or one of the military departments or any other department or agency within the federal government. And appellants would suggest that, in fact, the internal review applied by the various departments and agencies is not entirely consistent. There are some significant differences, for example, in the way that the Department of Defense Central Adjudications Facility applies its regulations or its policies versus, for example, the Department of the Navy's Central Adjudications Facility. There are differences. There may be, although appellants regretfully are unable to speak with certainty, there may be significant differences in the level of review that is allowed given the distinction, when there's a distinction between a security clearance versus eligibility to occupy a sensitive position. Appellants also wish to point out that if something as ephemeral as litigation can change a national security designation, then what else? Such a completely arbitrary process does not square with the board's authority under 1204, 7512, or 7701 of Title V of the United States Code, and it cannot be what EGAN or Congress intended to protect. And indeed, as came up, I think, when the board questioned agency counsel as well as amici with respect to expertise, and this is in the record, in 2003, DFAS had approximately 35% of its employees designated as sensitive. 2 years later, virtually overnight, they had 100% designated as sensitive with a broad brush. That is not expertise, that is arbitrary. And in the same vein, for example, the board's review, when asked, I believe Vice Chair Wagner was asking, what would be the standard? Well, I direct the board to look at the cases and appeals that it has adjudicated involving, for example, law enforcement personnel. The board certainly has the authority to review the full scope of merits, but in recognition of some of the particular facets of law enforcement personnel, the board also routinely holds them to a higher standard. There's nothing inconsistent about that, nor is there anything that would prevent the board from doing likewise, should it choose in these cases. And let us dispense immediately with the fallacy, if I haven't said it before, that the term security clearance is not a term of art. It most certainly is. As shown, if you look at Executive Order 13526, which replaces its predecessor 12968, which was cited by Amicus AFG, I believe in page 9 of their Amicus brief. This executive order provides a detailed scheme for the identification and protection of classified national security information, and it explicitly describes the types and the only types of security clearances as confidential, secret, and top secret. All of the indicia, in short, of a term of art. And again, the lack of clarity regarding whether it should be a Form 85 or a 486 to be used, that clearly, to appellants, argues in favor of establishing the security clearance as the bright line to balance the national security concerns present in Eagan and the rights of federal tenured employees and the powers of this board. And appellants wish to express their disagreement, I believe, with agency counsel for DECA. Eagan relied heavily on Cole versus Young, as well as CIA versus Sims, to inform its decision in Eagan. It relied and quoted the portions of those two decisions, Cole and CIA v. Sims, regarding classified information. It is ever present in Eagan. That case is replete with references to the need to protect the national security information. And that is why appellants respectfully suggest that the board should not extend Eagan to cover appeals of adverse actions arising from an employee's loss of eligibility to occupy a sensitive position when there is no security clearance nor access to classified information. With that, I'd be perfectly willing and happy to take any questions that the board may have.
I've got a couple of questions. I stated before that it seems to me that your argument rests primarily on the contention that a security clearance is distinct from the determination with regard to eligibility. Is that correct?
Yes.
With the Executive Order 13467, are you familiar with that?
I regret that.
In June of 2008... the executive order was issued, and that seems to conflate, actually, all of those concepts, eligibility for sensitive position, security clearance. In terms of the purpose of the executive order, is, at least from reading it on its face, is to align all of the processes for making those assessments and to make them consistent. What significance should we attribute to that in terms of determining whether, in fact, security clearances should be considered in the same, or eligibility determination should be considered in the same light as security clearance revocations?
I regret that I'm not fully familiar with that executive order. However, appellants would argue that it should not control the board's decision because, again, we look to Eagan, and it is Eagan itself that carved out the jurisdiction of the board. And so Eagan created the limited carve-out based on classified information. Where that is not present, Eagan simply doesn't apply, and although there may be a subsequent executive order conflating the two, the argument remains the same, that the concerns that drove Eagan are not present here.
And just one final question. I mean, is there anything to be made of congressional action or inaction in this context? I mean, you know, we have Congress having authorized and then let subside the NSPS system, which would, you know, suggest that Congress did contemplate the possibility of bringing whole groups of employees outside the scope of statute. Do you have any comment about that? And what we should make of congressional action or inaction either way?
Certainly congressional inaction or action may not be the clearest indicator of congressional intent. However, appellants would argue that here, congressional inaction does speak to what the board's scope of review should be, because if Congress sought to restrict it further, it could have done so and has not done so. And given that when you read Eagan, you must read it as tied to national security, classified national security information, appellants believe the conclusion to be drawn from that is that Congress allowed Eagan to continue but it did not act to extend it, nor did it act to restrict the board's otherwise full scope of review.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Grahalis.
Thank you.
This concludes the oral argument in the appeals of Conyers and Northover versus Department of Defense. The parties will be given an additional 2 weeks to brief on the three questions that the board posed to them on September 16th. Briefing will be simultaneous. These briefs will be filed no later than close of business Tuesday, October 5th, and the record will close on October 5th. An order will issue from the board later this afternoon. On behalf of the board does thank the parties, their counsel, the MIKI, for the time and the detail they put into their arguments and their briefs in an effort to educate us to better inform our decision. Thank you. This hearing is adjourned.
All right.